I'm here with my dear, dear friend, Lewis Black, who everyone will tell you is the nicest human being on the planet, especially in a business filled with assholes. So I love you, and I thank you for doing my podcast because I know how busy you are. And by busy, I mean you stay in your apartment as much as possible and avoid human beings.
Yes. Yeah. I like to sit around and I do a lot of cutting when I'm home. I like to take a razor blade and try to create a feeling.
Well, cutting is what the younger people do. I'm surprised you know that.
Well, no, I know all this stuff. And I thought it was, they gave me a good lead on something. And I think cutting is wasted on the young.
Do you have advice for people who want to start cutting and what they could do?
Stop. Leave it to professionals. Leave it to people who know what pain, who know what pain is and don't know what emotion is. Don't worry, you'll have an emotion someday.
How do you...
And it's more painful than cutting.
How do you... when you... Okay, let's talk about sort of... I'm playing with the mic here because I'm trying to...
I know, it's a very impressive piece of equipment.
Shut up, jerk.
He's really, seriously, it's a giant mic. He's waving it around. It's really impressive.
It's kind of phallic, right?
No, it's not even phallic. It's just... But it's really impressive. The lights are on it.
The lights. You like the lights.
Yeah, well, that's what you probably paid for. They went, oh, look, and the lights come on.
Shut up. Ass. So now, you grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Yeah.
A Jew. A lot of Jews in Silver Spring?
Yeah, of course.
Really?
Yeah, we took over territories, just like the Irish. And the, you know, we. Yeah, there were a fair amount. It was a pretty mixed, outside of color, outside of race.
It wasn't mixed in Silver Spring. How was it mixed? There probably were no
Jewish,
Catholic.
Italians.
Catholic. Oh, Italians? You had us there?
Everybody was there. The Irish, everything was there. The Catholics are all over the place. Two major Catholic schools. And you can't just prop that up with the Irish. You need, two major ones, St. Bernadette, St. Camilla's. The Regina High School, the girls' high school.
Yeah.
Girls' Catholic High School that was really, we used to just drive by it and weep. And then, and all my guys, I hung out with, the guys I hung out with, it was three Jews, two Catholics, and the rest were like Protestant.
Really?
It was really mixed. Well, because it was all middle class moving from the... They all moved into apartments in D.C. after the war, and then they started building, and that's when they started building.
Mother, a teacher. Father, artist and an engineer.
Yeah.
Now, did you get your artistic bent from your father? Like a painter? Your father a painter?
He became a painter. He initially did stained glass after he retired and then
started stained glass? Painting. A Jew doing stained glass?
Yeah.
What do you get out of here?
Yeah.
That's a Catholic.
Well, not Italian. It isn't all like...
What do you guys have to take over everything for? Can't you let us have anything?
Oh, yeah, really? Like, what we really like to do, what Dad liked to do, really, was to sit around and do a little thing with the manger and, Christ, yeah, we were working. he made little chais, as they call them, and...
Wait, what was that?
Dub a piece, chai. It's a chai, C-H-I-A-I. It's a Jewish symbol. It means, I think it means happiness, or it means I'm getting ready to phlegm. Something like that. But he made mirrors. I've got a mirror of his that, with Victorian stuff around it. He did professional stained glass as opposed to you Catholics who need to kind of keep regenerating this myth over and over again. Oh, boy, if it's in glass, it must be true.
It must be true. And by the way, here comes the collection plate three times. I grew up middle class in an Italian neighborhood in Providence, Rhode Island. My father put floors in for a living. Everybody was basically a tradesman in our neighborhood. We'd go to church every Sunday. They would come around three fucking times with that basket. Like the third time, like, did you not get that the first time this was it? Like, it's not like I'm giving you 75 cents in three 25 cent increments, This is how guilted you were into money. At eight, I did this. I forgot to take money. I went to church alone that day, and I felt so guilty that I didn't have any money to put in that I pretended to put, I faked it. Like I put my hand over the basket as it came by, and then I stuck my little index finger out farther than the rest of my hand, and I went dink. I made a like a chain dink noise. Like that's the effect of the Catholic Church on a young boy.
Well, I think the reason they passed it around three times was the first time they passed it around, and they probably raised about $125 and 75 was stolen
by the other people.
Yeah. So then they had to send it around again to try to get back to the original number in hopes that by the third time, the rest of the crowd would feel guilty enough to put it back. And that's my theory, and I'm sticking to it.
All right. You scored very high on your math SATs.
Yeah.
Which you don't seem like a math guy to me. You're all about.
I was a great math guy. Weird.
You were the last person, and I think anybody who knows you as a fan would say, I don't see math. Although Jew, good with the numbers.
Yeah, well,
but
I don't know why. I was always good at it. My mother had a really good sense of it. Mm-hmm. So I kind of.
Did she teach math?
No, but she just had that thing. You know,
yeah.
Thing. And then, and I did. And it's. Which in essence is kind of like, I ended up writing plays, which is in a sense like doing math, only it's with words.
How so?
You create a problem. The problem is you've got these characters, and we're going to put them in this place, and we want the characters to go from point A to point Z.
Right.
And we'll put them in these situations, and then you basically have created this problem that you've got to fill in. You know,
okay.
You've got X equals the characters, Y equals the situation, mm-hmm. Z equals the play. So, you know, it's coming up with, how do you adjust your X and your Y to get your Z?
Well, I never looked at it that way.
Nobody does, and it's why my plays really read like that.
That should be the billing for your next play. If you like math, you'll love Lou's Black Latest.
But, I mean, that's where I thought the thing went, kind of. That. But I mean, because I think... Actually, if anybody had really taught me what it was for, as opposed to just teaching it, that was my genitals.
What's that? That was just sort of
a little somebody. Well, that's somebody sending me a little text. That's it, a little text message to my nuts.
Wait, was that whistling your phone?
Yeah, it's my phone.
And it whistles when you...
Yeah, and I don't know how to figure out how to fucking get rid of it, and I kind of like it.
If I send you a text right now on my phone,
yeah,
which I'm going to do,
yeah,
it'll whistle?
Yeah.
All right, hang on, here we go.
Yeah. I'll take the fucking phone out.
This is his phone whistling.
This is my phone whistling. Anybody who's got a Samsung knows this and loves the whistle. And it's different from it's a lot of stuff happening. I can't really go on with the interview. I've been texted, and I let's see.
It's me.
It is you. You didn't send three of them. The others may be really important. It could be for my mother. Don't talk about math.
Don't talk about math. You know nothing about math.
They actually...
Will you stop reading your phone while I'm interviewing you?
It's a lot of stuff's happening here. I hate this.
Do you like the Samsung better than the... Did you have the iPhone?
I've had everything.
By the way, I
did have the iPhone.
When you call Lewis's voicemail, he always has the best outgoing message, giving you his latest frustration status with the cell phone industry.
Yeah, and now I've moved on to Sprint.
Yeah.
I've gone back to the beginning.
All right, I think yours now is, I'm on Sprint. Let's see how they can screw me now.
Yeah, exactly.
Leave a message.
Yeah, and they have. They've already started.
So when you're... Now, you're applying to these schools, you apply to...
Well, let me just finish the math thing so
yeah.
You can edit this.
Yeah.
The thing with math was, is they... I was really good at it, but they never told me what it was for.
Right.
So I had no idea what... I mean, I was doing of a test...
If you had some sense of, like, well, how I can apply...
How
I can apply it this way. Oh,
you know, like statistics or economics or anything.
Right.
But it was totally in and of itself. Algebra 2, I did calculus. I went all the way through calculus, right. Fuck 2. And you kind of go, well, when are you going to show me what this all is about? Never even in the real, nothing.
But if you were so good at it, wasn't there some sense that, okay, I major in this, engineer, accounting?
Nothing, because nobody had shown me anything of any interest. They didn't go, with this talent, you could.
Yeah, but I would think, clearly you're born with an innate ability to communicate. You're an amazing performer. and you like to help people, and you're smart. You put all those things together, I hear the word teacher, professor. Do you ever think about being a professor?
Not until later. Initially, I thought about the Foreign Service.
Really?
Yeah.
How do you get to that from math in Silver Spring, Maryland? I don't know.
Because the State Department was, you know, downtown government.
Were you always interested in politics at a young age?
I just kind of thought, you know, I thought it was an interesting, I was interested in politics, but I was much more interested in, like, you know, oh, you can, you know, the whole thing, you travel, you learn a language, da 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 da. And then I read the qualifications of it, and you really had to know a language really well. And I went, that's not going to work.
Why did that surprise you? It's weird because you're like really smart and then really dumb at the same time.
I
want to go to foreign. I got to know languages.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it was part of what, but it also I kind of lost some interest in it. There was nobody, you know, a lot of what I think shapes what a kid ends up choosing is there's got to be someone in the room who kind of, you know, is a model for you that you kind of go, oh, I'd be interested in that.
Yeah.
And I didn't have that actually in terms of theater, but I did have as I was going to theater with my father, and so that kind of became, I became really interested in theater because that was, there it was in front of me, and it was may have been impractical, but at least I kind of got it.
And how young, how?
I started going to theater when I was 12.
Really? Okay, yeah.
So the fact that I'm straight is really... Unbelievable.
It really is.
It is. A lot of stuff happened. Lots of things. These are all very important.
That is the funniest. It's not an intrusive way to be notified about something.
No, and especially if it's like, right next to your nuts, because the air comes out of the Samsung.
And it blows on your
nuts. It blows on your genitals, which is really what's the best part. Let me lower this.
No, leave it. I think it's better if you leave it. I'd rather have you leave it because it'll be fun.
Yeah, but it'll really just bother me because there's so much happening. I really don't know why I'm wasting my time here.
Shut up. No, so
TTYL.
So you're an ass. So now this is what I was curious about is sort of how you applied to a bunch of colleges, got into Georgetown, but decided not to go to Georgetown. I went to Georgetown Law School, so fuck you.
Yeah.
And
Yeah, but you were from Providence.
Yes.
So
that was a big deal.
Well, no, but it is. But also, you're getting away.
I did want to get away. I lived at home. I went to Providence College. Lived at home because I had to work in the family furniture business.
I wanted to get
the fuck out. Exactly.
Yeah. And for me, it's 8 miles away.
Yeah, exactly.
And they didn't. And also, they didn't have a theater program. And at that point, when I was getting out of high school, I thought I need to go to a place that at least has... I didn't think I'd go into it, but I wanted a program to see if I was going to...
But you're not just pretending to be a smart fuck, which everybody thinks you are, but you are a smart fuck, because there were, like, Ivy Leagues that you could have gone wherever you wanted to go. You ended up at UNC Chapel Hill.
No, right? But I got rejected by the Ivy League school.
Oh, you did? Oh, so you're not a smart fuck.
No,
okay, good. I was right about that.
Brown, big disappointment. Brown, Yale, Princeton... And then Amherst and Williams.
Yeah, but you ended up going to Yale Drama School, so you got to...
Yeah, but that's not...
What?
That's not...
Yale Drama School,
no,
come on.
But it's still... It's theater.
So how do you end...
It's not like... you know, it's like... it's saying, and he went to Yale Forestry School. Which there is one, apparently. So for those of you kids who are looking to get your Yale degree... Because a lot of the guys who ended up, or the folks who ended up at the Yale Drama School were people who... At some point, wanted to go to Yale. I'm glad I didn't go to Yale.
Why? Why are you glad?
I thought it was up at some, because it's Yale is Yale and Princeton are both the heads are up their ass about being what they are.
Yeah, and Harvard is too. I got a bunch of friends.
I mean, it may be less now, but when I was going there,
And
Harvard less and Brown could
see. I don't know Harvard. I got friends that some of them just define their entire lives, even at 45, 50, as Harvard.
Like. Well, yeah, no, but in terms of the atmosphere of the school,
yes,
Harvard's more relaxed. Yale seems to, and Princeton seem to be worried about that. God, we really got to be really good.
Yeah.
And Yale. I mean, I have friends who went to Yale. There were no women, so fuck that. That was just
because you wanted to keep up that ruse that you were straight, even though you were musical theater and everything.
That no women thing is just too creepy. And but I had friends there, and it was, I mean, it's really fucking, it's a hard school. I mean, it's not kidding around hard.
Yeah, you know.
They're not kidding.
Yeah. You know? So how did you end up at UNC Chapel Hill, which is a great school?
It was a great school. It was an accident because I went to the university. I had to go. The only way out was there were some schools like University of Chicago. There were schools that showed an interest in me. Mm-hmm. When they found out, because you, essentially back then it was it was hard then, but a little less crazy, and so certain schools found out that I was, you know, saw my because my guidance counselors completely panicked and realized they'd screwed me over, so they started sending my stuff out to these people.
Wait, how did they screw you over?
By advising me that I would get into Brown and I would get into Williams and I'd get into Amherst. Those were my safety schools.
Oh.
Which is nuts.
I didn't get into Brown.
Yeah.
But my SAT scores weren't great, which frustrated me.
Well, neither were mine. But you would.
But what was it about you then that your guidance counselors thought you were a shoo-in for these schools?
Because I was the top male in my class.
There's a great story about you. You did a fundraiser for your high school, and you yelled at one of
Math teacher who kept me. I would have been
People the story.
Well, I'm doing a fundraiser for my high school, which will give you an idea of where we're at when you're doing, you know, since they don't tax anybody for anything, so now you got to go back and do fundraisers for your public school. Because these pricks in that neighborhood don't pay for their schooling. And it was a great school. So I did the fundraiser. I'm in my old, it's literally the old high school auditorium. And the gym converted to the auditorium. And my math teacher, my old math teacher was there, who gave me a B on my final thing of the year, you know, the final course I was taking. And that B cost me. I would have been the top person in the school.
You would have been the valedictorian.
Yeah, I would have been the valedictorian. So I finally had a chance to tell him what a piece of shit he was for fucking me over. he could have given me the A, and I deserved it.
That is awesome. See, this is a side of you, and I've known you a long, 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 long time.
Yeah.
I had no idea you were this smart in high school and college. Like, I had
but
no idea.
It's not smart. It's just...
a good student, because you see... I think because, I guess, to me, there's an inherent... rebel in you that like could be smart, but fuck you, I don't want to get good grades, I don't need it, whatever, like kind of thing. But
yeah, but I mean, I was, but also, I mean, I'm in the end, the tail end of the group of people who, like, you know, that when an adult said something, no, it didn't have to be in it, you know, you kind of they you know, they still had some sort of power over you. Yeah. So I was, and you know, the whole area was kind of like, you know, everybody, even as, because my friends were all really kind of bright, but you know, but they were all kind of off the track in their own fashion. And but we all felt this sense of, you know, well, you know, we're here, you might as well learn this shit.
Well, this is what, late, and we also the late really, 60s?
Yeah, yeah. But we also had really good teachers.
But that's a rebellious time in our culture, and I'm surprised.
But it was just before the shit hit the fan. So yeah. It was like 64, 65, 66, so it's just coming on. And we were, you know, kind of rebellious, but they kind of gave us a certain amount of leeway. They weren't like sticking it to you.
Yeah.
You know, they were really, I mean, they asked really smart questions. They were really, I mean, all of them, I mean, two of them went on to ran their educational departments in the county. I mean, we were really lucky. We got a group of very young teachers who were really, really good.
Good.
Who wanted to be teachers.
Yeah. So the Kennedy assassination, you're like old enough to remember it. You're old enough to... Any effect on you, you think, sort of in looking back? And
yeah, it had a big effect, because it was like, you know, I mean, as much as the Kennedy assassination had an effect, so did the shooting of...
Martin Luther King.
Lee Harvey Oswald.
Okay.
Because you kind of went, okay, this is crazy.
Yeah.
And then they shoot Lee Harvey Oswald, and you go, holy... God. I mean, you know, you just... Because it basically busted the myth. The myth was, you know, you live. I mean, we lived idyllic. I mean, for all intents and purposes, it was an idyllic childhood.
He was an embodiment of that too. Like that ideal.
Yeah.
JFK.
I mean, yeah. I mean, everything was. Yeah. We're rolling along. You know, nobody's supposed to shoot people in charge.
Yeah.
You yell at people in charge. You don't shoot them. You know. So that. You know, it certainly colors my feelings toward. I mean, I still, Dallas pisses me off. He really does. It's like,
have you ever worked Dallas? You ever
but I work Fort Worth.
Really? You won't go into Dallas?
I don't do Dallas.
That's hilarious.
No, I don't. And they don't show up. They show up in Fort Worth. They don't show up.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you stay away from grassy knolls? Do you ever use the word grassy?
I use the word. I've touched some knolls.
But yeah, that had to be kind of a kick in the head at that point.
It
right?
was a kick in the head.
It sort of, it's a really good point. I hadn't thought about it in that respect, but it really sort of, it was a watershed moment in our culture in that I don't think you can ever go back to the idealism that we had before.
Well, because everybody was kind of, you know, we had everything. I mean, you know, we had a real middle class. Mm-hmm. It was a real operating middle class that had, you know, there were parks for us to go to. There were places for us to play ball. Everything was kind of set up around us. There was no, you didn't really know that there was not a pedophile living every 3 doors away or
well,
something.
Well, they were. We just didn't know about it.
Well, yeah, but even with that, you had no sense of it. There didn't seem to be.
Yeah. I do.
Nobody. Remember. I mean, I knew a lot of kids. I mean, we were born and raised in that neighborhood. We started together. We went through high school, and we never had a sense of any
right.
And there, a bullshit going on. But the Kennedy thing really did kind of pull the rug out from under everybody.
But that whole era, then Martin Luther King, RFK. I mean, there's. In some sense, bad things have to happen for great things to happen, maybe, right? Sort of out of that came, you know, obviously, and who knew Lyndon Johnson would sort of be a champion of civil rights, right? So it's sort of like, was it inevitable in some way? Look, I mean, we have the benefit of hindsight now, and you lived through it, you know, clearly remembering it. Like, was it inevitable that kind of horrific, those kind of horrific things had to happen for the amazing... Advances.
No, I thought they were. Kind of appalling. I mean, I would take the exchange of keeping. You know, I mean, King. They can go. Well, you know, for all the sleeping around, whatever. Nonsense. I mean, yeah, who gives a shit?
I mean, whatever.
When you're in the presence of greatness, you know it, and I've not seen a lot of, you know, you basically we wipe the boards of great people, and you can say, well, because of the fact that the information and yada 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 and all that stuff that the culture we live in now undermines that ability, but I don't think so. I think greatness trumps all of it, and you don't have a lot of great people. Great people just don't show up.
Right.
You know? Right. It's not like a great factory.
Do you put Obama in that category?
No. I put him in right place, right time, smart, cookie.
Yeah.
But
for Jesse Jackson, is there, you know what I mean? I always feel like Jesse Jackson in some ways doesn't get his due. I mean, clearly a clown in some respects, but was sort of that... You know, I think our culture is such we can't take major change right up front. I think what has to happen is that there's an adjustment period. So, like, the idea of a black man in the White House was first proposed essentially by Jesse Jackson, but we weren't able to swallow that pill, and because of him, we were made Obama more palatable. Is that?
I mean, I think that the Obama came out of the Bush, and I think Obama was the I think for kids I think that was their 60s moment, concentrated in about a 2 year period,
right,
without a lot of and a focused 60s moment, this is our chance to really to do it.
See, I think commerce and the need to make money by the networks, and I think cable news is the worst thing that ever happened to American politics because it's made us more divisive, and there's a money factor involved.
Yeah.
And I'm guilty of it. I go on some of these shows, and obviously you're entrenched in the world of politics and comedy, and on the forefront of it, and you were even before The Daily Show. And I feel like because you have the MSNBCs of the world and Fox News of the world who need to make money at this, they're going to just keep encouraging this sort of divisive conversation mm-hmm. that doesn't really turn into anything other than more divisive conversation.
Right.
So I would think in the 60s and 70s and 80s and when CNN first came on, that it was sort of a, there was a, it was a gentler time in some way, and I don't know if you agree with that or not.
Well, no, because it was in some way, it was, what was, the thing that I say in my act now is that the difference between that time and what proves that, how incompetent the, this Congress and leadership in general is that the difference between that time and this time and why we got stuff done is those people were alcoholics. and drunks get stuff done.
How so?
Because they sit at the bar, you know? I mean, you know, tip on, you're the best. You're the best. You really had a good idea. That was a good idea. And they can compromise because they hang out and they have a personal
time. Right.
These people don't have to take personal time together. I think that's as much as a problem because it was pretty violent at times. There was a big, blowbacks going on. If you watch the amazing thing as a kid, you're sitting there and watching, what turned the corner as much as the death of King was that, you're turning the TV on and you're watching these people get hosed and dogs biting. You just go, really, what is the matter with you?
Doesn't look right.
It doesn't look right. It was kind of like people were going to go down there to be freedom riders, and those guys were, extraordinary. I mean, I just, by the time I was 18, it was like, you want to go to Cuba to cut sugar cane? That was the thing. It's like, no, I'm not going to Cuba. I'm not coming back with fucking malaria. Are you fucking nuts? We're not doing it. But I do think that this time, too, is an expression of...
the time we're in now.
The time we're in now is that if the left, there was my generation, in essence, had an inordinate amount of power for a small group. They were given that power.
And that power manifested itself in the change that they were able to affect through civil rights movement.
Well,
and
also because, partly that, but we really kind of pushed on, we just kept pushing. The Democratic Party to go left. Well, and the Democratic Party did not really, the Democratic Party eventually put its foot down, but it led to Nixon. So, and I think in the same fashion, the right what we experience now is a response to that big push back then. In the way it kind of went through the culture,
and so you're getting the Democratic Party, the liberal party,
Now you get the right wing pushed. The right wing is pushing, and the Republicans are just beginning to kind of come back against that problem. And for all the right wing yells about community organizing and all of that, and Obama being, they're the ones who took the lesson,
right.
The reason we're partly in the shit we're in terms of communities around the country and, people not teaching, evolution and stuff is because, those people installed themselves. They said, okay, well, this is what we're going to have to go do.
Well, it's a good point. I mean, I think what you're saying in the 40s and 50s, sort of the Democratic Party was closer to the center. And with the 60s and all of the issues in that era, it kept pushing left to the point where the country said, okay, enough. We want to be more conservative, which led to Nixon. And what you're saying now is has essentially been doing that.
And it ended up pushing in Obama.
Right. And what they're – I mean, look, Karl Rove got moved out of Fox News. I mean, he basically – the idea that sort of you can have a party that's more moderate than right wing or extremely left wing falls on a lot of deaf ears still, which I don't get. Like a lot of Republicans talked about.
Very important call. This is a very important. I know this, but
you have the gayest amount of sounds on that phone.
This is my.
Go ahead. You can just take it.
My agent.
Go ahead, take it.
No. Let me just. Tell him I'm calling.
You're like an old man with a VCR. You know how to work that?
I know how to work it. I'm just trying to figure out.
Go ahead, take it.
I have to call Jim back. I'm in a very important podcast. No, but tell him I'll call him back in a little. I know he's got some very important news that'll be life changing. All right, thank you. Bye.
This is awesome.
I needed to talk to you then. You lost the job.
No, don't make me feel bad. No,
don't worry. It's not going to happen. All There's right. nothing. If I'll tell you, if there was shit on the line, I'd have fucking taken the call.
You asshole.
But really, good luck this afternoon on your pitches.
Yes. Yes, you're pitching a very big show to Comedy.
Huge, massive, life-changing. Yeah, Comedy Central, FX, we're going all of them.
It's going to be an animated show.
Animated show. It's not going to happen. So hold on to your hats.
Can I be in the show? Can I have some role in it?
No. You don't want to be in the show.
No, by the way, just to take
the show doesn't exist. When the show doesn't exist, you can.
A moment of sincerity. You, if it were not for you, I wouldn't probably be a stand-up. You took me out on the road with you. I emceed for you. I featured or middled for you. If people don't know what that is, there's three acts on a show. You would be the headliner. There'd be an act before you. That would be me. And gave me advice. I remember taking trains with you out to Princeton, New Jersey, and helped me work on material and helped me formulate an idea for my own show. So for all of his curmudgeonness, he is the most generous human being I've ever met, and truly like an older brother, and I appreciate everything you said. Having said that, I think this is a perfect time for you to come out of the closet. but just to circle back to what we were talking about with politics and our culture, after this last election with Obama, all of the Republicans were using this phrase, we need to do an autopsy on our party and see what the issue is. We need to do an autopsy. And then fiscal cliff, the sequestration issue that's just happened, nothing's changed. Like, they're still firmly entrenched in government, less tax, blah, 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 all of that.
Yeah, well, but what they did do was they realized, you know, it was like they woke up and went, oh, wow, they're gay people. Gee, I forgot. And they vote.
Right.
It's almost as if they thought, you know, gay people. And then a bigger revelation is they realized, you know, now we're going to deal with immigration eventually because they realized that they lost because of the Latinos.
Right.
So, and that, you know, they don't seem to realize that, you know, it was like just dawned on them.
Well, the irony is
disingenuous.
Right, exactly. I mean, you trump up Marco Rubio as sort of the counter to the State of the Union. And it's sort of like, it's very transparent what they're doing. And they don't get that the American public, and I think we can both speak to this, having worked a lot in front of live audiences. Audiences may not be IQ smart, but they're emotionally smart.
Yeah.
They know if they're being bullshit. My father put floors in for a living, blue-collar guy, high school educated. He read the paper. He had opinions about politics, and he knew he could sniff it a mile away if somebody was bullshitting.
Yeah.
And what I don't think they get is, like, in terms of the Latinos, the value of the Latinos generally mirrors more Republicans than Democrats. They tend to be... they're very religious, which means, you know, a lot of them are very Catholic, which means they're, you know, anti-birth control, pro-life, conservative with their money. So you would think that party could tap into them, and for some reason they can't figure it out.
Well, because they don't, you know, because apparently they're all of these Latinos who came in came into the country illegally, and that's really what, you know, they're just insane.
Right. Right,
and they can't figure out that you can't, you know, deport that many people.
Right,
and they refuse to actually pay any attention to the facts that that this whole thing of people sneaking in is dying because Mexico is actually getting an economy.
People say, "I'd rather stay here."
They're insane. I mean, they really are clinically insane, from the argument from the beginning. Okay, if there was like 500,000. You might go, okay, maybe we could do that, but there's not.
Right.
And as I've said in the act too, you know, you're the one who's advertising your country, you stupid pieces of shit.
Meaning the Republican.
Everybody. Yeah. Republicans, we're the greatest country on earth. You know, boy, you really want to live here. Well, tell them it's a piece of shit.
That's a good point.
You know?
I never thought of that.
You know, fuck you.
Hey, it's great. Come on over. We didn't really mean that. Wait a minute.
Visit and you show, if you want to visit, this is what you get. But if you want to stay here and then show like 16 Japanese or Chinese living show every fucking case of people being shit on.
Jammed into a subway at 7
exactly.
in the morning.
Exactly. Right. You know, it's like, come on, you fucking idiots. You know, you're the ones who... Oh, boy, you really want to be us. And then they show up and go, well, you know, we had to sneak in. to be you. You're fucking morons. You're crazy.
Oh, my God. It's a really good point. I didn't think of that. Now, did you have a, I mean, obviously, so you kid a product of the 60s, you're potentially interested in foreign service. You start going to plays with your dad when you're 12. You start to go, oh, that something resonates with you when you see those plays.
Yeah.
Do you start writing plays in high school? How do you become a playwright? You were a playwright major at UNC Chapel Hill.
I couldn't act. I couldn't direct. I mean, I had no interest in directing. I had no interest. The only thing that I thought, I'd written this thing with my friends. We had a talent show.
Mm-hmm.
This was the hook. It hooked me on stand-up and on the thing. So we had this talent show, and generally a talent show is you should get the talent and the school together, and they audition, and da-da-da-da, and then inevitably...
This is in high school.
Yeah, and inevitably the way in which it's presented is it's always, you know, like two old ladies going through their memories, and then they conjure up these fucking acts, and it's just a horrifying... You know, it's sweet, and it's nauseating. So we came up with the idea that we all wrote ourselves in, and that I would be. So I wrote this part, you know, that essentially they were coming into audition, and so I was a talent agent, and you know, and showing the age thing, you know, to the talent agent, and they were coming to see me, and I would get them on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Oh, that's clever.
And it was kind of at the time smart, and then we had my friends played various kind of little roles within it. So these kids would come on, and they'd do, you know, whatever they do.
Yeah.
You know, play the saxophone, you know, play to the bumblebee on the saxophone, whatever the fuck.
On a the triangle, yeah.
Yeah, you know, the whole thing. Yeah. And then they'd finish, and I'd go, that was awful. So I would come up with, we had one-liner. I mean,
you get a laugh. And it was like a drug, right?
Yeah. I mean, because, and we, you know, it's a 1,000 people coming in, and we did it for 3 nights. And
and you're all of 16, 17 years old at that point, right?
It was my last year in school. That was the big hook. That was the one that went, okay, I got to really kind of pursue this.
Yeah.
But I didn't see myself as an actor because I wrote it, you know, so I didn't.
Oh, but you were performing in it.
Yeah, but it was seen more not as like a character, because when I tried to do a character, I was like pathetic.
Terrible, yeah.
You're
a good actor, though. I've seen you in the movies.
What irritates me probably as much as anything else is not being, but I have, and I can't be that irritated because my friends who are really great actors aren't getting work. That there are things that I could do that I'm not being even asked to audition for, you know, or I'm kind of dismissed because they don't, because I've become very comfortable with it.
Part of it isn't, I don't think it's a reflection on you. I think it's you know, people have difficulty seeing people outside of what they, I mean, so stamped as.
Yeah, I am.
Not just a comic, but there's only one Lewis Black in the comedy world. Yeah. I mean, and you're in the pantheon. I mean, you're up there. I mean,
no, it is that. You know, it's like my friend, you know, anybody, like Marklin, my friend Marklin Baker, who's did a great Perfect actor. Strangers,
and you
know,
and you've grown up in the industry together with.
And
Marklin.
I watched him. You know, he's kind of stamped as Cousin Larry, and then so he basically has to go and direct for a number of years to get out from under the thing. It's just a tough. But I'm kind of but what happened was is that that kind of hooked me, and then so I ended up. I spent a year at the University of Maryland to get grades to transfer to a place that I knew had a theater school. And I'd looked around at these, like the University of Chicago had been interested. There were all these schools that were really interested, but they were either located in places that I knew I would kill myself, or like U of Chicago had no, you know. In retrospect, I kind of go, wow, they had a great writing program. They had no...
No theater program?
No theater program.
What about Northwestern?
I did apply. I applied to Northwestern. I applied to Chapel Hill. I got into both. Northwestern, the reason I ended up at Chapel Hill was it was near my friends. My friends Ray and Tom were at Duke. And because I walked down to the Chapel Hill, and because Northwestern cost 5 times more. I mean, Chapel Hill cost really at the time... Practically,
really?
For the time, nothing.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, but that was before they, you know, it was before, you know, it became like the same amount. you know, or a chunk more than, you know, to go there.
Right.
You know, now it's expensive. And then it was not, you know, expensive. It was like, you know, I would say it cost all told, you know, for me to go to school, $250 a month.
Jesus, really?
With everything.
Wow. Based on what you've achieved, that's about the quality of education. Yeah, good for you. Good for you for bargain basement on your education. Yeah. That was a really smart
move. Well, they were a really good school at the time, and it was tough to get into, but they had a theater program. But what really did it was, as I arrived, of all of the campuses that I'd ever gone to, I arrived on the campus of Chapel Hill and felt like, oh, I get it. This is where I belong. I belong here.
Yeah.
I really like this, where I'm standing, and I like this, and I can be happy
and
here.
At this stage, you know.
So and I don't study anything. So I have no idea what I'm getting myself into. I fucking just liked being there. And then I realized, oh, man, there's seven men to every woman here. Are you shitting me that there's a curfew for women?
Really?
Yeah, that died. A lot of shit died.
Has that ever changed in you, that sort of you? I know you don't really write your act. I mean, you pretty much have a seed of an idea, and you go on stage, and you just start to formulate it. And then you'll tweak and play with it. And I know you're on the road with John Bowman, and he works with you too on some stuff.
Right, yeah.
It's fascinating for people who don't know. I mean, Lewis, I've never seen him with a notebook. I don't think I've ever seen. Can you write? Do you just sign when you do contracts? You just like an X, like an immigrant. Like I've never seen
shit
out.
I have notes, but they're just notes. I never write.
You never sit at the now, which is ironic in a way to me because you're a playwright, so you are a wordsmith in a huge way, and yet why is it that for your act you're not doing that?
Because I always, from the start, when I first started doing it, I was just telling stories. Mm-hmm. I always started that. I mean,
had this style early on.
Not the style, but the not writing.
Yeah.
You know, the style came later, but I mean, when I was, I had like 6-7 really funny stories about my sex life. So... and I would tell those stories. You know, people would say, tell the story, and I'd tell the story. And then when I started going on stage, I would tell. And I realized that there was nothing to write down because I knew the story. So what am I going to go, you know?
Right.
You know, and and then when I eventually wrote it down, when I got to, I thought, you know, but when I was still, I was always fooling around with, I would do stand up and quit and do it and quit. And so when I got to the drama school, I said, okay, I'll write it down.
This is Yale.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to, you know.
Master's at Yale. He got his master's at Yale Drama School.
So I'm going to write it all down. Now I'm going to write these stories down. And then I'm going to, you know, do that the way I wrote them down. So I do that. And then I become so obsessed with what I wrote down that I fucking lose any of the juice of the story.
Yeah. And by just so people who are, that is a really, really important thing you just said, because you and I talked about this. The first time you tell a joke or a story works perfectly. And then it takes me like fucking 5 more times to get the magic back.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the hell, what happens there? What is that? Is it because we're so excited about telling this for the first time?
Yeah. And you discover that, you know, a lot of the times you discover the things you thought have worked. And so that does it. And then the other thing is you immediately, even though that happened, you start to tinker with it.
Yes.
So you go, you know, if I just do this,
make it a little better, and then you make it worse.
Yeah, right. And then you just start to make it worse.
Yeah. And by the way, this is where I disagree with you. You are a great actor, because to do what you do and the kind of comedy you do, you have to replicate. I mean, you're telling these stories over and over again. And what is that, a bicycle? What is going on? What are you, a 17-year-old girl with this phone?
No, that's Facebook, maybe.
But every sound is a sound a 17-year-old girl would have on her phone.
This is what's in the phone. I didn't ask you, for these
But
sounds.
You could pick more manly stuff.
No, because then it'd be like, you know, it's just like, no, that bum, bum, boom, bum, bum. Yeah, it was Facebook. Very important.
You're on Facebook, too? I'm very proud of you.
I'm not. I'm on Facebook. Literally, that's what half my act is now about.
It's
like being in a torture chamber.
No, I know. I went to see you on Broadway your last run. It was great. And
it's like a torture chamber.
So great. And like, so proud of you to see you up there on Broadway. It was like, holy shit, he's on Broadway.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
That was fun.
So when you're doing it's people have to understand that you have to replicate the enthusiasm, and you have to convey that story like you're telling it for the first time when you've told it 200 times that year already.
Right.
That's acting chops. That's performing chops.
Yeah, it is. But I mean, I like, but also it's what I like doing it. And I mean, the big hook was that for me was that, you know, these people never heard it.
Right.
That's the thing. You know, it's not like I'm on TV and I did it. What I get crazy is when I'm on TV and I did something, and then I'm going to be doing it again in front of people who've heard it.
Right.
And then I realize too that they do like hearing it again.
Yeah. Yeah,
they do.
I've had people come up to me and go, you know, I'm clearly not at your level, but no. People come to me and go, oh, you didn't do that breastfeeding joke that you do about your wife breastfeeding. And then, so it's a little bit of like, you always want to give them something new, but there are, like, it's sort of that they want to hear the thing that they
Well, because
they
bring
the
somebody, and they go, wait till you hear this, and then you fucking ruin their day. Well, fuck them. Fuck them.
Does that ever leave you that need to want to please as a stand-up? In other words, like, obviously we do it for ourselves, and I think I'm better at it than I used to be. You've been doing this longer than I have. It's like, does it ever leave you that, like, do you ever walk up the stage feeling like, I hope they liked it as much as I wanted them to like it? Does that ever matter to you anymore?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, no, sometimes I feel like I'm trying this thing now that I can't tell you about because I don't want people to know about it until it goes seriously. I'm doing this stuff.
New stuff in the act?
Yeah, but the way in which it's being generated.
Okay.
And
is it like a goat involved or anything like that?
No. Chicken. Chickens.
You hack. You're stealing my chicken preparation.
And it's also the same is true of any. When I do anything new, somebody mussed up the back of my phone.
You're very upset.
when I'm doing something new, that I kind of go, like I'm working on this my sequester material. So I'm started doing. Let's take that as an example. And so I go and I've started it, and it's not really funny yet.
Mm.
So I get, people like it and applaud it, but it's like I'm going, I leave the stage thinking, fuck, I've got to make this funny. This is not funny. This is just fucking, rabble fuck things,
Sometimes I get, I have a defined, okay, I'm going to do this in this set. It's second show Friday in a somewhat blue-collar town, and, like, they don't, I just know they want to hear about, like, the easier stuff.
Right.
I'm not doing McDonald's drive-thru jokes, but the easier stuff for me being like, stuff about my kid and my, relatable stuff. And I want to push them and whatever. And sometimes I'm good at sticking to my guns, and sometimes I pussy out and I don't do that stuff. Well, and I don't know if that ever happens to you. Well, I wish I were braver at times on stage in those moments.
But to me, it's a matter of when you're in that position, you always kind of, I think you have to layer it, that you can't just push them. You basically kind of hear some... Here's some stuff you'll like, and now boom!
I call it ice cream and carrots. I give them some ice cream, and then you slip a carrot. Yeah. It's like a baby, and you slip a carrot in the
that's
side.
That's exactly
of them.
The way, and that's the way you do it. I think that's the one way to fashion it. Because for me, it's that's the way in which I basically, even when I'm putting in new stuff, I know that I'm doing this beforehand and this after. So
you got to cover
it,
right?
Because in the end, no matter what. Whether people like it or not, you're there to entertain people.
Are you doing it for them or are you doing it for you?
I'm doing it for the Lord Jesus Christ.
You're a Jew. What are you talking about?
Well, I was. And that's what I meant by my new work that I'm
doing. This is stuff you can't talk about.
I can't talk about it.
And the reason I ask that is I ask myself that sometimes, not to get too deep about this, but like,
I'm doing it for me.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was doing it for them, my career would be much further along. I mean, seriously.
No, but if you were doing it for them, I disagree. I don't think you would be who you would be because you'd start to fashion stuff.
Oh, I wouldn't.
This is what they want. And then you'd be a fine stand up and you'd be good and you'd be a solid headliner, but you would not have exploded the way you exploded to that level.
Well, no, I mean, but I think it, if I had not, I think in part it was mostly because it was just, if I was going to do it, that was the way I was going to do it. I had no choice in the fashion that I ended
That's
up
a
doing.
Really good point because how did you find your style? In other words, for me, I was captivated by people said, when I was a lawyer, blah, 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 I never planned to do this. And then I started writing jokes as a hobby and sold some jokes to Leno. He did them on The Tonight Show. It blew my head off my shoulders. And then he was like, go try the jokes out. So I'd go to dive bars around New York City. I got my first laugh. It was like heroin.
Yeah.
And blah, blah, blah. And people say, well, do you know you were going to? I'm like, no, I didn't know I was going to. I clearly was on a path to be a lawyer. I mean, yeah. I, you know, there's nobody in my family entertainment. But I remember, like, the only time I'd ask to stay up late was to watch stand-up comedians on Johnny Carson. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter who it was. It could have been Jonathan Winters. It could have been Rodney Dangerfield, David Brenner. Were you captivated by that? Because I know that you said you jumped in and out of stand-up.
Well, I did. I mean, but I was captivated. I mean, I watched my parents liked Nichols and May, and they had these review albums. They used to do these musical reviews in New York City written by people who eventually became like the writers of MASH and stuff, like Larry Gelbart and Ron. So there would be these funny song, songs about human relationships and stuff, and then, or whatever. Or something that was going on, like Tom Blair type of satire.
Right.
Google it. And then it's like
Lair.
Tom Lair, L-E-H-R-E-R. Still good, still funny that we don't play him because it would be, oh, God. I don't have a record player.
So, and Nichols and May is Elaine May and Mike Nichols. Mike Nichols directed The Graduate.
Yeah, and he directed Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Right. Look, Google that too while you're at it.
And he's married to Diane Sawyer, which is not a bad piece
of...
Right.
No, and I've sat next to him while watching Whoopi Goldberg. That is my claim to fame.
Wait, what do you mean, sat next to him while watching?
When Whoopi Goldberg was on, did her first, this is one of the first off-Broadway show.
Her one-woman show.
But she did it at she just came into town and did it at DTW at the time, the Dance Theater Workshop, and it's like 150, maybe 100 people in the room, and my friend Judy Ivey, an actress, said, do you want to, I'd read a review of it, and I thought, fuck, I'd really like to see this, and then she called and said, and she was doing a show, and Mike Nichols was directing her, and Mike said, do you think we should go see this show? And Judy called me and said, do you think we should see this show? And I said, fuck, I'll go see, you want to go see it? I'll go see it, because I think we should see it. And then, so he got us tickets. And we all sat together, and I sat next to Mike Nichols, and we laughed at exactly the same stuff.
Oh, really?
And then afterwards, he said to her, I want to do this with you. I'd like to work with you and do this. Basically, he said, we're going to work together on this.
Hmm.
So I consider myself the mover. And I've told her this, too. I consider the real reason that her career is...
His career. Time. You're the reason she has an EGOT. She's the only, one of the... Right? Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony.
She's got all of them.
She's got all of them. You have a Grammy. A lot of people don't know that.
I got a Grammy and an Emmy.
Oh, you got an Emmy, too?
Yeah.
What'd you get the Emmy for?
I got the Emmy for my work with John Bowman on the NFL on HBO.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, we did about... 10 or 15 little before they moved them, then they moved them. We won the Emmy, so it's
so you're halfway there, and with your love of gay musicals, Tony's right around the corner.
Tony's coming.
I would pay $1 million to see you try to sing. God,
and then that's coming. And then there's I don't know, the Oscar's tough.
Now you could do it.
It's gonna take real something.
I think
amazing. She's got that. She's got all of them. So Nichols and May. I was listening to them. Mm-hmm. I was listening to. They didn't really have
Lenny Bruce.
Well, not early on. Mm-hmm. I started watching. It was mine. Was not. It was It was Carson, but it was also. Steve Allen had three guys who were all Tom Poston, Jose Jimenez, Louis Nye. So they were all kind of stand-ups, but actors.
Yeah.
The first play I saw in New York was Tom Poston was in the show. It was not a great show, but I went, oh boy, I get to see Tom Poston.
Yeah.
So I watched those guys, and Steve Allen, in a sense, was kind of a really crazy. Ernie Kovacs was really phenomenal.
Yeah.
And then I would watch Ed Sullivan for comics.
Yeah.
So there was, for everybody from...
Bill Cosby, Carlin.
Cosby, Vernon, Carlin, Jackie Mason. I saw Jackie Mason,
Shelley Berman.
Yeah, Shelley Berman, Bob Newhart.
Oh, yeah.
So then we started... I started, so I got a Bob Newhart. I either got it or a friend had the Bob Newhart albums. I listened to that, you know, and it was just, it fascinated me. I just didn't.
What was it about it that grabbed you? Because at this point, you're a fresh sophomore in college?
Or? No, I'm literally a freshman in high school.
So what was it that grabbed you?
Even 12, 13, I just found it interesting. I just thought, wow, this is the weirdest. It's just weird. People get up, they do this, people laugh. What the fuck is going on?
Hey, look, there's a mouse just ran across the floor.
No, don't tell people. Is there really? Yeah, I have to tell Steve.
We have a guest on the podcast.
God, oh, man.
No, she's just
going to be very upset.
It's just like you're so captivated by
it. Oh, boy. So
So now you're listening to this, but no idea that this is going to be a career for you.
None. I mean, I just think it's, like, interesting.
Yeah.
So I just liked them, and I thought they were funny. And
and when did you start doing
stand-up? I mean, I listened to this. I mean, I could listen to, there was this stuff that my parents, these review things that my parents had. Like, it was about, you know, one of the first things I ever remember really laughing at was bad, this poetry corner, and it was like, you know, somebody was like Emily Dickinson, and then this you know, blue-collar guy, you know.
Yeah.
And he did this poem, and it's just so stupidly funny. And yeah. I could listen to it, and I would do it, and I just thought it was funny.
Yeah.
And you just get hooked. I just got hooked on that. And then the guys I started hanging out with were all funny.
Oh,
in
I
high
see.
School.
Right.
So that all kind of led to it. And then I started listening later on. Then by 15, 16, I'm listening to Carlin and I'm listening to Lenny Bruce and I'm getting a subscription to a thing called The Realist, which is,
what's that?
The Realist is a magazine that came out in the 64. It started to come out 63. I don't even remember when it started. It's a great, it was a satire magazine. Mm-hmm. I mean, but it was this guy, Paul Krasner, had put this thing together and some of it was his writing and things of others. So they had like the centerfold of, that I have on my wall now. That it was one of the first, I was 15, I started getting it. It came in like newsprint. I mean, it was like crazy. And and it would come kind of covered and my parents never seemed to check. I don't even remember how I stumbled onto it.
Yeah.
And I opened it up, and I went, this is in the, one of the first issues was the, all of the Disney characters, as if it was a Disney, you know, is Dumbo and Minnie and Mickey and everybody, all the characters on this black and white page.
Right.
And so you look at it, and first you look and go, oh, what did they have this Disney thing for? And then you realize every one of them is doing something completely perverted. And I was like 14 or 15, and I've never, and Davy Crockett and all that Disney shit have been so big, and this really just blew that one out of the water. I was, that is fucking funny. So I showed it to my friends, this is fucking funny, and we started, my friends actually started a cartoon book in high school that if it was ever picked up, we would have been, I mean, I did stupid stuff in it, but they were really good. I mean, like, unbelievable. I mean, just stuff, shit would happen in the school, and I mean, a guy, you know, can't even imagine doing this now. A guy kills himself. You know, and we're like in the seventh grade. Mm-hmm. He kills himself, and this cartoon book starts among these guys, and it's and even later on, it may have been later on because it was traumatic. We didn't know the guy. We'd been there like 2 months, and this guy, 500 kids, and he kills himself. So it's like, okay. So then they used to come up with explanations. They do these cartoons, like, you know,
right.
It was the first autoerotic thing I'd ever heard. You know, why would somebody do that? Why would they hang him, you know, to get a boner? You know, it's like, well, get a boner. And so then there was a cartoon with the guy getting this big grin on his face with a boner and da-da-da-da and stuff.
Right.
You know, it's the stuff that we would have been, you know, we all would have been gone for counseling. And it just got worse and worse and worse. I mean, the stuff that went on, and it was funny. But we were conscious of it being funny, not twisted.
But but that's a fine line between funny and twisted.
Well, I mean, we didn't feel it was, you know, it was between us. We didn't. It wasn't like we were showing this to other people, you fucking idiot. And we weren't doing it. We were doing it because we did think it was funny.
Right.
You know?
Right,
I mean, stuff, Jesus. on a cross, you know, with a, you know, and he's, you know, and looking up at God and all of these people surrounding him, and he's got a big boner and he's shooting semen on everybody. I mean, that's, I mean, it's, that's.
Do you think that you're?
That's a 15-year-old or 16-year-old.
Yeah, but it's there's a subversive, an intelligence subversiveness to it, and I'm wondering, in talking to you, and again, I've known you a long time, and just in this conversation, it's hitting me like, it was a headier time then. I mean, you're obviously a social satirist under the broader umbrella of stand-up. I would put you as a social satirist. Would you have been if you grew up in the 80s? I mean, I think growing up in the 60s, do you think
and growing
that
up in the
made
60s,
you more
yeah,
it, of a minded to be a political, a social commentator?
Well, no, it's just what I focused on and the stuff that intrigued me and the guys I hung out with and the fact that we were outside of D.C., that was big.
That there was some shadow of D.C. that kind of
well, I
mean, cast
because
over.
It was, well, because yeah, it was right in there. Our face the whole time.
Right.
It was government.
It's the conversation at the dinner table with your parents,
yeah,
too? It sounds
everything.
Like your parents
yeah,
were
you know,
pretty
and
savvy.
And, yeah, and then, we watched Walter Cronkite was on the TV at 6:30. We'd sit down for dinner and we'd watch Walter Cronkite.
Right.
I mean, the kind of friends I had, somebody had the idea. This was, we were 17 maybe. We were seniors in high school. Yeah, we were seniors. So we came up with this, in order to get in the newspaper, we come up with this, one of them, the schmucks, one of Don, I think, maybe, I'm not sure, comes up with an idea that it's an international teen conference. So, and all of these teens from around the world are coming to Washington. And we went down, and I forget where I was from. But we were all from other countries, and Don, I guess, or I forget who was the guy who was the, and we were the first group to, we were the ones helping set up the conference, and he had this bullshit story, and the Washington Post came down and interviewed us.
Oh my God,
around,
really?
As we walked around, yeah, and we're doing this kind of pigeon fuck language thing, and it's like... So that was the kind of people I hung out with. They were crazy.
Yeah.
And then the only thing that fucked that up was they took photos. They did everything. It was going to make the paper. And then one of them called somebody, and the mother, somehow they found out we were both full of shit. It was, but we gave it a shot. It was stuff like that.
In high school. That's really smart stuff.
Yeah.
And that's really... Yeah. So at this point, it's a lock in your head. You're going to do something in the arts. You're going to do, whether it's
No, I'm thinking that's what I'm really interested in, and I'm going to take everything. I'm going to basically look at what else is available.
Right.
So I'm thinking sociology, but that goes out the window because they have a course at Chapel Hill. This is 1967. 67. Yeah, mm-hmm. The course is called The Negro.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah.
What's it?
It was a good course, actually. It was really good. I mean, it was actually great stuff to read and stuff. I mean, I took the course, but I thought, you know, this isn't, you know, they got to kind of catch up. They're like 15 years behind. This is not going to work. And then I thought psychology interested me, so I went and took a Psych 1 course. I took all the ones and nothing really. The psych department was all behavioral psychology. So you walked in and, you know, the pigeon fucking banging its fucking beak is the centerpiece of the guy. I'm serious. It was downstairs. I mean, like...
Seriously?
Seriously, the centerpiece, like, you know... And it was like, this is what we do. We're in behavioralism. Well, fuck you. That is of no interest to me. So we skipped that, and I just kind of...
Math. Math is still not something you think you want.
I took math, but
again,
that,
you
but
didn't know how does
you know,
this
I
apply.
I nailed it. Yeah. You know, I just nailed it. Yeah, okay, good. But yeah. I didn't. You know, econ. I tried econ, but it was at 8 a.m. I mean, seriously, and that never. I was one class, and it was fuck you. I'm not doing this. Your people are fuck you, and this guy is so dull.
Yeah.
But English, really good English, and really good. And theater, which was kind of goofy, but it was. But there were really good students. We had a really. There were some really good actors.
Did you have professors that you love? Like, I'm finding my son now is really gravitating to subjects where he likes the teacher. If the teacher's good and engaging in the classes,
he just wants to sleep with him.
It's all guys, but you know, hey, I'll take it. You know.
All right, well, then whatever.
Talk about the pot calling the kettle black. But did you have any teachers that influenced you at that time?
No.
Like, like in terms of like
no, there was no. Well, I didn't have any good ones. I mean, in terms of theater, there were some that were good. There were some that were interesting, and were kind of inspirational in the sense, but didn't really, as far as playwriting went, I was not getting much from them.
But you're not majoring in playwriting yet at this point. You're sort of figuring out what you.
I'm
want
figuring
to
out what I'm doing.
Which
but
is
I
smart.
Had, oh yeah, but I did have. I mean, I had the one great teacher I had who basically was remained a friend for quite some time, and I kind of lost track of him. Was a guy named Will Gear, who was the one of the reasons I ended up, I think, getting into the school. I ended up stumbling into his office by accident, then took his course. He taught a course in modern civilization, which you had to take. It was like one of the track courses. You had to take this course, and, you know, he had a class of like 200 people, and he would just throw challenges up at these kids about, you know, he took like the words of Billy Graham and put them alongside the words of the guy who was selling indulgences for the Catholic Church, and would say, who do you think is the indulgence guy? Who do you think, which one's Billy Graham? And so he was just throwing this shit right at him.
Sounds fascinating.
And he was great. Yeah. I mean, he was a really good teacher. He was really about kind of thinking for yourself.
Right.
And because he came out of the Southern tradition, it was like, you know, get a grip and drop a lot of this shit because you got to.
What do you mean? Explain for people what you mean by the Southern tradition.
Well, I mean, he was born and raised in the South.
Right.
So I forget. He was from, I think he's from North Carolina. He may have been from further south, but it was North Carolina. Was still North Carolina when I went there. I mean, they were not
still. Well, they were called the Negro.
Yeah, I mean, now it's inundated with Easterners. I mean, guys who went down from the north. So,
but all of this experience and this kind of education, it just seems to be the foundation and informs your stand up today. I think it's very thoughtful. It's very challenging the system, you know, a lot of that sort of what your themes are seem to harken back to these experiences. And again, maybe this is the product of the 60s, I don't know.
No, I think it's a lot of it had to do with Chapel Hill, and a lot of it had to do with Yale.
Yeah.
A lot of it had to do with the people I ran into. A lot of it had to do with not being, of always just doing it on my own. Because nobody, I kind of initially knew nobody was going to do my plays, so I did all my plays on my own. I just knew nobody's paying you for this. Right. I'd always had a.
You would produce them. You're now writing plays at. Chapel Hill.
Even at Chapel Hill, I would do them. I'd go to the guy and say, "Okay, can we do this?" And I'm gonna. And so I'd go down. You know, I'd get two actors, and we'd go show it, and people would, you know, 10 people, 15 people would watch it. So I had some sense of what was going on because they weren't doing it. And then I wrote another play with another group of actors that became hugely successful, and that kind of hooked me into it.
What play?
It was called Feast. Mm-hmm. And then also at that point in time, Robert Anderson, who wrote Tea and Sympathy and I Never Sang for My Father, Google him. He came to town and read my stuff, and he's the one who said you should continue to pursue that.
Wow.
And that was big. So that kind of kept me on the track.
Came to town, and this is at Chapel Hill. Wow.
So that did it. And then we formed our own, and this group of us that worked together formed our own theater, and we pursued it. And I had always felt, I thought that the National Endowment did a great job in terms of, I'm somebody who's for it and against it. I mean, I thought it was important to help in terms of get a regional theater movement out there, and it was successful in that. But that really, in the end, the theater's problem was that, if it wanted to be great, it had to really sell tickets. So my whole idea was, okay, well, let's see if we can sell this, because, and there's nobody's going to pay. I always thought, no one's paying me to do this.
Right.
Except my parents, except I would say, lend me 50.
Right.
But nobody's paying me to get this up, and we would do it.
Right.
And we just did it on our own, and so that always informed what I was doing.
In what way? That you kind of were self-sufficient?
Self-sufficient, and I didn't have to go to somebody. I just
So you
didn't.
Could say what you wanted to say.
Yeah.
In other words, I think your point about the money part of the plays is that you didn't have to sort of commercialize or bastardize your art.
And I didn't have
art.
To suck somebody's cock to get to the, oh boy, I bet you're a good... you know, to get to the next level, you know, that I could just go do it. I didn't need to go there.
Right.
I didn't need to,
and do you think
to
that,
go to somebody.
Do you think that attitude's carried forward with you as a professional and as a stand-up? In other words, like,
yeah,
you're amazingly far along. Let me just throw it out there. If you sucked cock better in the business, would you be farther? Like, does that...
I think that, I mean, I don't know if this is true. I do think that if I had spent more time in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. that I might have done better on in terms of film or TV. I didn't.
And why didn't you?
I didn't like it.
Yeah. Just the lifestyle and just...
The whole
thing. One-note industry.
And I spent a lot of time... I mean, when Mark was out there, I spent... Before I really even had a career, I'd spend a chunk of time out there with him and wandering around doing what at that point was called pilot season, and you'd audition for a bunch of stuff. And and I wasn't... but I wasn't really... good at what I was doing yet.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a matter of, oh, I've got to, you know, so I, but I just didn't like the let's go in and, you know, and do this. And I was experiencing things that, like, when I went up for, you know, it's on one of the CDs that I said, you know, I auditioned to be myself.
Yeah, tell that story quickly. Yeah,
well, I mean, Joy Behar had a show, it was called The Rock, and, it was about a high school, and she was I can't remember, she may have been the principal or teacher, it was funny. And they basically saw me and took, for all intents and purposes, my act, and fed lines from my act into this character, and I'm sitting around, this is so long ago, it was about smoking, I had smoking jokes, I had these jokes, da-da-da-da. And then I auditioned for it, I didn't get it. And I was really enraged,
so you had to audition for your
to play me, and didn't get it, and I did it, and I was good. And the thing is my audition was good, but they gave it to somebody with more TBQ, which is, you know, somebody who was better known.
TBQ means likability rating.
Yes, yeah. Somebody who was known, Paul Sand. But what really stunned me about it was I went out and I just have to.
Oh yeah.
Oh fuck. Oh. I'm going to have to go pitch.
Oh, geez. Okay. Sorry.
Frank Gorshin, Dan Hedaya, and I forget who else, were all there auditioning to play. I think they were auditioning to play the principal. And I thought, Frank Gorshin, you've got three guys. Really? And you've got these? And I thought, this is, you know, you do all this work. You know, you create a body of work. Dan Hedaya's less, let's say, at that point, but still, I knew his work.
Yeah.
This is 15 years ago, and he'd already done great, great work, and Frank Gorshin was truly already. And the other guy, and I said, you can't pick one of them?
Yeah.
If you can't pick one of them, why would you have him come in and hang out? This is demeaning.
Right, right.
And so that backed me off.
Which I think sort of ties back to your experience of putting your own plays on. In a way, it was probably the best thing, because with the stand-up, it's like, fuck you. As long as I have a microphone and some people in an audience, I don't really need anybody to do my craft.
Yeah.
And you being a rebel sort of by nature, and sort of, it just makes sense that that's what you gravitated to and became brilliant at, you know, because otherwise you would have wasted your talent in LA, spinning your wheels, going on the same auditions with everybody else, and eventually started booking stuff.
Yeah.
I do think it's the thing where you've got to do it for a while and, and then eventually kind of.
But I just, and then my friends were out there and they weren't really work. And the thing was, is stand up was work. I mean, I could go do work.
Right.
I didn't have to fucking. Right. And it is. It's like Dom Irera said, others have said, you know, I mean, the thing is we're not beholden to anybody. If we can get work, I mean, if we're good at it, we can go do it.
Right. So it's funny. I can't remember who said this. It might have been Mitch Hedberg or somebody. It's like, people come up to you, so you're doing stand-up. So when are you going to be on TV or film? And it's like, isn't it just good enough to be like, it's like you don't go to a plumber and go, so when are you going to start being a good carpenter? Like, on some level, in a weird way, there's not a respect for the art form as a pure art form in and of itself, or a craft, or whatever you want to call it. that takes a tremendous amount of time and effort to do well.
Yeah.
You know?
No, there isn't. But, and it's because, you know, because everybody says, you know, I can do that. Yeah. I have to actually.
You
got to
go. Listen, thank you. There's a whole lot more I want to talk to you about, so maybe another time we'll do another
one
of these. But you're the best.
No, this
thank you
great.
So much. You're on tour. You have anything? Hey, by the way, one of your books is on Amazon for $5.18.
I know.
So how does it feel that your book is selling for less than a cup of coffee at Starbucks?
No, but here's what's interesting is I sell it when I go on the road. For the real price with the signature.
Whoa! That's it. Hey, thank you so much for doing this. You're the best. Love
you. Thank you.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you.
All right. Bye. Okay. Hey, it rang one more time.
It did.